So that's good. So 2 months ago, I was warned I should give this talk. And then there was a certain new technology that if you make some slides, it didn't have there's a drawback that you won't be able to read most of it. But I had fun doing it. That's the preliminaries. And so what I just want to do is talk about dark matter and how to think about dark matter in phase space and how it moves around in phase space and how that actually then can give us a new way of sort of looking at simulations of dark matter and analyze them in substantially new ways, of course, measuring very similar quantities we always wanted to measure. But, I'm quite excited about it, so I'll try to get that across, and I think it'll open up a number of new avenues of what you can use this technology for. In writing new codes, which are hopefully of use in understanding dark matter dynamics in the universe. But if the dark matter doesn't work out so well, we still have collisionless plasmas. And there we've already also done some testing. And some of these new techniques actually look very promising in the arena. It's not sad for dark matter. Okay, so what we first got to do is sort of think about dark matter as a sheet. And then I'll just have a few basic things of how we usually go about simulating on a computer how dark matter evolves. Then get us thinking a little bit about how phase space works. It'll be perhaps too pedagogic in the whole early part. But I know we have a lot of people here that work with these type of in-body simulations, the dark matter simulations. And I just want to give you a flavor of how straightforward it actually is to use our technique to analyze dark matter simulations. And so after I explained all that, how it works, I'll show you a little bit, okay, what is it good for? What's it look like? What can you do with it? And just give a little bit of a flavor of that. Before I move on, to talk a bit about how to use that technology to write new simulation codes that are in a way fundamentally different than all the in-body techniques that we've had available the past 40 years or so. My co-conspirator is Oliver Hahn, who's doing this post with me at Stanford, and Rob Kara, who works with us on visualization and is a permanent staff at CIPAC, where I'm from. Okay, so the dark matter sheet, for 98% of you, you all know this, but our sort of working hypothesis is that dark matter really is, or the hypothesis is that it's some unknown elementary particle, quite heavy, and we like to call that thing cold. And so I just want to remind you that even particles of the KV range, so 100,000 times less massive than our canonical expectations, even those still would only move at sort of meters a second at the present day, if in the absence of structure formation. Okay, that's just an intrinsic velocity dispersion that you would have had even for relatively light particles. But it'd still be quite slow. Now the fun thing is that the universe, of course, started in a very homogeneous state, and about that we're very certain because of the cosmic microwave background observations we have. We know it was extraordinarily uniform in the past. And this makes us interesting now. So if dark matter was formed very early on, it was uniformly distributed through space, and it was very cold. So if you think about it in phase space, all your spatial coordinates and the velocity coordinates, it's the simplest configuration you can have. In the spatial coordinates, you just have a uniform distribution and zero extent in any of the velocity directions. Okay. And so that's why we keep calling it a sheet, even though it is a three-dimensional manifold moving in a six-dimensional phase space around. But that's what I mean by sheet. it is just a three-dimensional manifold, completely uniform, same everywhere, and no velocity extent. Okay. Now, the fundamental, of course, if it were a 100 GeV particle, then we would have about 10 to the 67 or so of those particles in our own galaxy, which is quite a bunch. So that number, of course, is much larger than the number of stars in the galaxy, and it's also much, much larger than any number than we can fit on a computer today. So in principle, we really want to think of this as a collision that's fluid. Just that,
into the eighth, if it's an axiom.
Exactly, right? And you can have like somewhere that you probably couldn't leave it. Oh yeah, axion. Yeah, exactly. So it could be just enormous numbers. So, you know, your gut feeling, by the way, is that you should think of this as a continuum, right? For all purposes, you would sort of define a space density and say, okay, it's just like the molecules in the air here. We're not going to give them all names. It's just too many of them. It's just not relevant. So we just talk to them about the gross properties. How many do I have per particular volume? And then we usually don't even use those numbers. Give it in grams or something. Anyhow, so you want to sort of solve a continuum equation. And the nice thing from what's often called the Grignard-Boltzmann equation, or in physics more the Maslow equation, all it is you have a density in phase space that you just look how it evolves in time, and it couldn't be any easier. All it says is that velocity affects things in the spatial direction, and accelerations affect things in the velocity direction. Okay. And so, equivalently, that sort of encodes this whole business of the Liouville's theorem. You have a fluid in phase space that's incompressible. Just gets moved around. The only extra complication we have is that these accelerations come from the gravitational potential. The gravitational potential itself is just the projection of this phase-based density into configuration space. We project the six-dimensional thing into three-dimensional space to get the actual mass density at any given point in space. That sources via the Poisson equation here the gravitational field. And once you have that, you just take the gradient of it to find the forces for any given point in space. So we have continuous functions everywhere, and the whole thing is very nicely well defined. So why aren't we doing it? Well, of course, the reason why we're not doing it is you already have six spatial dimensions here. Six dimensions, three spatial ones, three in the velocity direction, and we want to evolve it in time. And so if we wanted to solve it on a computer, we'd start out by opening a six-dimensional matrix and then try to do it forward in time. But even on the best computers we have, that's usually a very bad idea. So, you know, unless you make the extent in one direction, maybe 10, you just get a million points, and that's good that we could handle. But we wouldn't get a lot of information if we just have a 10 by 10 by 10 sort of spatial information about the whole universe. It's not only that, it's actually not such a good thing to do, because we just talked about that this dark matter sheet actually in your six-dimensional hypothetical array on your computer would now actually only take up one of the rows in all your velocity bins, i.e. zero velocity in all directions. So in a way, right at the beginning, you would have wasted an enormous amount of memory. And so that was the big realization for us, or just when we first understood this, and we were, of course, not the first ones to realize that. But it, to me, it really hit me that, oh, it's really just three-dimensional. We never really have to worry about all the other velocity components. And all you have to do is you only have to know the velocities of the sheet itself. All the other regions in phase space that are not occupied, we don't care about. So you don't have to store any zeros. And so that's going to be the key here, that we're really just tracking a lower dimensional structure to a higher dimensional space. And I'll go through examples in one, and two, eventually 3D. Okay. that's what I had so far. And I think mostly, I already explained everything I have on the slide, just to remind you that things would be very, very cold, of course, because if you think about at what redshift did the universe have a typical energy of 100 GeV, it was a very high redshift. Right? And you can always do this just thinking about the CMB, 1 EV, a redshift 1,000 or so. All that's to say is, if you have a heavy wind-produced burr early on, it was so early that the density in the universe was actually very high. But by the time it expanded now, whatever velocity it had, it's really zero today. And in fact, if you wanted to give back the velocity dispersion that the dark matter had at the time it was created, you'd have to manage to get the dark matter so dense again, so compressed back to the initial densities that it had to sort of get back that velocity. Right? And so you just use that incompressible in phase space. And so you can think of just any whatever material you have a certain volume compared to the velocity dispersion volume that is set up by that. To say if I want a high density, very small volume, then I could get to also again high velocity. Anyhow, so the whole thing's super simple. We have a distribution function that's a delta function in all the velocity directions, and it's constant in all the other ones. So now that I just want to get us thinking a little bit about phase space itself and super pedagogical here, to go slow a little bit at the beginning. But again, let's do it in one dimension. So along here we have one spatial dimension x, so velocity direction here. And then we think of just a sine wave in velocity. So the classic case, and so Dovich studied and sort of this early phase managed to get an analytic solution for it. Where what you find is, okay, all these particles appear in the positive part of the velocity. They're, of course, moving in that direction. These are moving in the negative direction. So you've got this wave that's getting steeper and steeper here. And eventually, you get shell crossing. So that last point here is just where all these particles sort of line up in this region, nature. Crossover. Okay, so now let's sort of think a little bit more about this. When we do this with numerical simulations, instead of actually solving any of the fluid things, right, we really just draw up an n-body system. So we think we're doing with Monte Carlo, the distribution function phase space with discrete points. And that's fine. We're really, because these are just points that trace along with the fluid, perfectly fine assumption. But the extra assumption that we make is that it's these points that are also carrying the mass. And so every single one of these points of these dark matter particles we keep talking about that we now space out in such a way that they have about the density that of the fluid that we'd like to model. Okay. Just space them out and give them velocities according to our initial profile.
Okay. It's not quite just force on something. The points are actually something characteristics. So the full solution to the Boltzmann equation is like infinite amount of characteristics. And the equations of motion for particles are just characteristics of the equation. So you're just approximating the full solution by limited number of characteristics.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I meant is by sort of sampling the velocity, the distribution function of these particles, that point and affecting them along characteristics is a perfectly right thing to do. The thing that is a little bit funny is that we think of these particles sort of as little containers that have a particular spatial extent, a softening length. Which that part is the one that's not very consistent.
Acceleration,
yeah,
that's cool.
Exactly. So, and so then you affect them along characteristics, the advection, that part is imperfect. The only thing you might worry about is, do I actually have enough particles at this point to sample the distribution function? And does that matter, right?
that's my convergence, because you always approximating, right? You don't never have a full solution. For full solution, you need to have 10 to 67 or 10 to 80, right?
So you in this limit, right? In this limit, because you represent, because we solve it as an n-body system, so we only attain the fluid limit when n goes to extraordinarily large.
You don't need to be a fluid limit. That matter is not a fluid. It's a particle system. You're just solving the Boltzmann equation, because that Boltzmann equation is already an approximation. Well, already, it's full is just full endpoint distribution, right? And for fluid, it makes sense to average it. But for that matter, it's just... You can do it, or you don't have to do it, essentially.
Well, right. But if you go in the last equation limit with a few points, you can represent a continuous function. In the n-body discretization that we have, with a few points, we are very far away from the continuous. If we have 3 points to sample this way, it will be a disaster. So the question is, starting at which end do you actually start behaving like a fluid? And there's tons of very deep questions in there about when you sort of do it with this Hamiltonian system of, that, we should have more. But let me sort of go through and I'll explain a little bit more, perhaps, of how my terminology goes. I just want to do something very simple now. So we represent it this way with a discrete set of particles. And now we're interested in, say, extracting the density from our calculation. It's very complicated, so how are we going to do it? Typically what we do is we pick a control volume, any volume, count how many particles are in there, then I know how much mass I have, divide by the volume, I got a density. Sort of, right? Because in a way, I wanted to get the density somewhere here, but what I really got was the average density, all averaged over this volume. So I picked this delta x and I counted 4 particles and I found, 4 times the mass of a particle is in this volume. There's sort of an average density, so it will always clip and I will not see any sort of really high density spikes. So that's one. Well, another technique we often use is adaptive kernel fluid, sort of an SDH style approach, where we go and just find the n nearest neighbors and over those have a kernel function that allows us to define a volume to then have mass of volume get the density. The other one would be sort of Voronoi approach, which in this case, in 1D, which is mean, well, let's find the midpoint between 2 particles, the midpoint between the other neighboring particle, and the volume between those midpoints would then be assigned to every single particle. And so again, that's at the minimal volume close to that point. And now we would have the mass of that volume would give us a local density. Okay. That works really nicely, and in a way it doesn't average over such a large region. That's why in principle it's a nice thing. But potentially it's fairly noisy. Depending just when particles move a tiny little bit, the density may change quite a lot. Do that. And so the realization we had was just that there's something much more simple you can do. How is that in one-dimensional case? Again, I say, wait a minute. So I've got all these particles, they're faithful tracers because they move along characteristics of the fluid. And so if I don't think now the mass being concentrated at the particles and then sort of spread around the particles, if I really start thinking about the mass being between the particles, then the whole thing becomes super easy because now I've got, all I have to do is measure the volume directly. So I say, okay, I know how much mass is between these points. The mass between these points will always be constant, right? Because they just move with a whole flow. I cannot have flux in and out past these particles because they affect exactly the correct flow speed. So this mass must be conserved in here. And so all I do is measure the volume, mass of the volume, just need the density again. But the cool thing here is now, this density is defined at every single point in space, and by definition there is no noise then a very simple case here, all I could have is a little chunks, because all I did was piece-size constant density assignment in this whole range. So this point here and this point here both evaluate exactly the same density, which you could overcome if you started interpolating between neighboring points, but you don't really have to now. Now that the density defined very nicely everywhere. So now if we do this for the same thing, just once it's evolved a little further, we get this nice crossing. We see these caustics on the outside, and you sort of keep spiraling around the center. And so I did exactly the same thing. All I did was measure the volume, the little delta x's, and give you the density. What you notice here now, though, is once you get in this case where you have multiple streams all at the same location, all that now means is that I just have to sum the density from this point, all the densities from these points. I should have drawn the ones from here too. All the ones that project down to the x-axis, I'll just, you know, add up all the individual densities from these streams. And that gives me a total density profile. But here's just what happens if I only do the sheet densities. And sheet densities here always mean just densities evaluated along the dark matter sheet. So in one stream, you know, this particle is flying in here. It just feels its own density from here. As it's coming in here, it sees all these other streams. So the total space density goes up for particles, but the sheet density particle is just the one contained in its own stream. And that's what I plot here. You sort of see all the densities now. It's the sum over this, all the multiple values that you have here that give you the total space density in the sheet. Maybe I'm going way too slow now, but it, just want to make sure that you get that. Now, I'm trying to think about the two-dimensional example, just very quickly. I tessellated the two-dimensional plane with triangles now. That's the simplex in two dimensions. And now I just think of this point and I'm going to move it over here. Okay, so move that point over there. And that's in a way where the complications are simple. When you look in two dimensions, you again will have many streams overlapping at any spatial location as you're looking down. But anywhere you had a fault, you'll always will find an odd number of streams. Okay.
I have a kind of dumb question. It seems like you explicitly assuming conservation of phase space density. Isn't that what you're assuming by assuming that it's a sheet?
Absolutely not.
But your simulation only measures the coarse grain phase space density, right? Which is not conserved.
Not in this case. In this case, it's really the fine grain phase space density.
That's the part I don't understand. How is it?
So let's go back. In fact, I have the full scribbles over here, but I didn't explain. So what we have is we've got the information for all the particles, right? And so I know up here how much material at what density is going at what velocity. Okay, so I know this one, I also know this one, I know that one, this one. So I can find all the streams that contribute to any given point in space, and I get all the velocity information. So the particles really trace exactly the fine grain distribution function, but usually we didn't know how to measure it. Because we thought of it, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of particles. And then we say, okay, what's the velocity of this burden? Don't know how to measure it. So what I do is I'll pick a big control volume again and say, okay, let's put 100,000 particles in there so it has decent statistics. And then I plot out the velocity distribution function, for example, right? And from that, I can then do moments. That's not true here. I can measure the velocity distribution function at every single point. So the way this goes is, you have to just sum over all the streams. And so what I can do is I can do a mass-weighted velocity of all these streams. So at any given point now, with this one, we get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 streams at this point, and I would get a dispersion, a very lousy one with 5 points, but nevertheless, at that single point, I would have now measured
But just by virtue of having smoothing in your force, you must have an effective smoothing in your acceleration.
Oh yeah, but I'm not getting there yet. Right now, I'm just pretending that the simulation is absolutely perfect. The particles moved on the characteristics they should have been moving on.
Okay, but I mean, in practice, you must have finite resolution in phase space, right?
Absolutely, and I'll spend a whole bunch of time talking about this, exactly. And in fact, you know, in these Hamiltonian systems, you've got this exponential runaway. You know, once you're in a very small orbit, that the sheet can grow without bound. So one thing you notice is that the length of this sheet has constantly been increasing as the simulation progressed, right, that we were drawing. So that's the volume over which dark matter is distributed. Now, but since this volume in actual 3D configuration space overlaps many times, right, it just can grow without bounds. And so regions in the very center of the galaxy, they will have had the chance to evolve dramatically. So all that means is like two parts that used to be nearby have been getting further apart and further apart and further apart. And so then there's a whole field, of course, of if you have chaotic orbits, you measure the Aponaut exponents of how these particles grow apart from each other. And so you're absolutely right. At some point, this will always totally break down. But that's a picture that's already in the simulations, and that's where I'd like to think about what that actually means for the simulation.
How do you do the interpolation in six dimensions?
So here, we just do constant density in phase space. So we assume the mass is contained in the tetrahedron, and I get to the tetrahedron in a second, but the mass is always contained in the element. Here it's a line element.
It's uniformly.
Exactly. And, you know, you could interpolate for it, and give you a little bit of interpolation for the velocity. But my experience generally, also from AMR, is that often you're more interested in doing refinement rather than trying to get a higher order installation.
And once your phase space distribution gets spaghettified,
yeah.
All these things get mixed up. You get that point that once you have a uniform distribution there, they all overlap, and you lose the fine grained structure. No?
Let me first show you what it looks like, and then we can sort of talk about, you know, because there's an aspect of it, but it's, it breaks fairly late. There's a few things that are quite instructive, actually, I think, even from this course solution that you have. Okay, so now we just want to do the same thing in three dimensions, so we have to move to the next simplex up, that's the tetrahedron. And for that, we know also how to calculate the volume. And it's a fun thing because these tetrahedra, you know, one point can move through the plane of the other three points, and it becomes degenerate, comes out on the other side. And if I don't take an absolute value here, I can get volumes, lumina, that are negative and positive in the calculation. That's a very useful thing. If you're interested in tracking caustic, that's a perfect way to do it, where the orientation of the tetrahedron changes. But for all the things I'm going to talk about today, I'm mostly really just using the absolute and always have a positive definite density. And so what we then do is when you think back in your simulation, you get a whole bunch of particles lined up in a Cartesian grid. So you have lots of little cubes, if you want to think about it that way. So what you can do is take the cube, divide it up into six tetrahedra. That's just one of multiple tessellations you could do. What's nice about this one is that all the six tetrahedra have the same volume. So they all carry the same weight. A little bit odd is that many of the vertices end up at certain points sort of bunching up a little bit. So there's a little bit of an anisotropy. But you can actually vary this around, and I don't think it makes much difference on the level you think about this now. Yeah, so that just means, so through this little element here, you can build up an entire tessellation of your 3D space very easily, and it's quite trivial, because we have such simple starting points where every tetrahedron at the beginning carries already the same weight. So now you just loop over your lattice, and you can generate all the six tetrahedra for every single cube in your initial lattice, and so you get six times the number of particles in tetrahedra. The only thing you might think about a little bit is what you do at the periodic boundary condition, but it's not difficult to do that. Okay, so now we've got the tessellation defined of how we have the initial sheet. And since the particles then just moved around through the simulation, there's nothing new we have to do. So we can take a Peebles simulation from 1970 and in principle still apply the same thing there. And right away do the things that get the density. And so here I just want to your projected density. That's a Bob Taylor's work where he does this on the GPU. I think it's up to a billion tetrahedra in 10 seconds or so that these new graphic cards can draw. It's just mind-blowing. That's a warm dark mass simulation we do because we'd like to see more of the filaments. But you notice when you compare it with your standard sort of adaptive SDH way of getting a density estimate, that this is much more fidelity. It doesn't show any of this artificial clumping. In fact, all this clumping that you see in the pure visualization here was actually not really clumping in physical space that the density would have gone up, because this density estimator shows like filaments like these actually have a perfectly well-defined density structure without any of these clumps that all come from just the kernel smoothing in real space. Right? By just looking at particles only in real space, estimating the density from that, you don't know how they distorted in phase space, and that's how you lump together these tracers, even though they're close in real space, but the mass that they trace would be much more diffusely put out because of mismatch.
Without some real structure, you cannot estimate it, cannot give you structure. So the clumping is exposed to real structure in the filament, which your estimate just averages out somehow, but you can't generate those clumps just by applying a kernel. If you do a kernel on Poisson distribution, you won't see.
No, I'm not saying these clumps are totally there in the particle distribution.
They are actually created by forces. Yeah.
Right. But the thing, if you actually sort of follow where the mass is getting sheared to, then you wouldn't have smoothed them locally. You would have put them flat. And ours, instead of smoothing, makes things much sharper. But the way these trace particles were moving, they in fact moved such that the filament, so let's pick which one is that, this one here, that you had some trace particles that moved apart in the filament, but you have multiple of the trace particles that arrive, which now when you think that the particles are the centers of mass, you think that it's, oh, that's a bunch of clumps. But if you think of them just being have been tracers, all the material between them also moved exactly like them. And even though you have, in this case, thousands of particles along here, all the tetrahedral shapes were exactly the same. So that even though the tracers look bunched up, the fluid density is still uniform.
I agree, but I'm just saying that particles are bunched up, so it's not just random.
Absolutely.
It's not always random, right? I mean,
no, but particles is
the only, the right-hand side is the way you compute the density.
Right.
You start from the left-hand side and compute it in the way you just described.
The right-hand side?
No. So we started, let me just show you something.
So if those intensity maps were constant, I would get different mass functions out of the left and right.
Absolutely.
Even for fairly massive objects. Oh. Even that big thing in the middle.
Right.
Okay. I mean, that's...
I think the right-hand side tells you that there should be no clumping. So left clumping and left diffusion.
But it's from the grid initial conditions.
Yeah. Left over, right? Actually, no. It arises less any initial condition you put in.
And also, so equally, they are spec.
Same.
It's just you want to
equal it. No, it's the same.
It's really just
same number.
A mutation of noise. You always have noise when you are in the particle separation. Right. It's only fragmentation of the noise. It doesn't depend on placement.
I think you're saying something else. You say that that is putting to the left is incorrect.
The distribution of the
particles makes it directly to that too. Yeah.
But if you then use that density, then what you're saying will become worse and worse.
Exactly.
But it's already
coming up to that.
That's right.
So the simulation was run with that density estimator, so it's already that problem already occurred, right?
These particles still actually all these lumps that you see here, they didn't experience any gravitational forces in this direction yet. They didn't actually clump up yet. This these slums are purely an artifact of that, how the tracers move. Actually, all the forces on the particles came. Exactly.
So
and there's some aliasing.
It's not just discrete sound.
If they would have slumped up a little bit, so if there would have been a gravitational force, if they would have been dominated by the local potential minimum that, looking at it, it looks like there would be a potential minimum, they're not affected yet. They still have all the velocity they had when they virialized in the filament. And that's why, that's what we can pick out so nicely here, because this estimator could nowhere be smooth, because there's just no smoothing here. So any slight deviation of a particle moving off in some funny direction, it's found very easily.
Simulation run in the standard way or?
Standard way. Both exactly same data.
But part of the law, right?
This is gadget.
Okay. But part of the left-right difference must be that effectively your adaptive kernel doesn't have the anisotropy of your particle distribution.
Exactly.
Whereas on the right, your adaptive kernel does.
Exactly. So here, all the tetrahedra are stretched into these tiny little things. There's a few rows in there of particles wiggling on very small caustics. And all the tetrahedra are as long as the mean particle separation. But now I have a bunch of particles here, and so tetrahedra goes this way, one other one points that way. Well, I still have particles that bunch up here. Which this one then pretends gives you a full density thing, because all you do is for every single particle, you just put sort of a spherical thing around it. Whereas in this case, these very elongated shapes, in these regions,
it's warm back there.
But it's warm.
Well, I don't know, maybe it's some first scale. Right?
Oh, yeah, sure. Either Redshift 100 or warm dark matter. And this is a very warm one, but I didn't even talk about scale. It was purely about the differential.
How bad is it actually if you, for each particle, use a density estimator, which is the shape of the tetrahedron, as opposed to actually summing up like you do everything which coincides?
Very. I mean, depends what you're interested in. If you're interested in voids, you get exactly the correct answer, because there's only one stream that contributes. But in, even for low-resolution simulation, you may have a few hundred thousand of these, adding all up to give you the central density. So if you just use the stream density, there you usually get the mean density of the universe. There's an enormous gap. But that's a typical stream density.
Does this work because the points don't move very far away in first approximation? Because if they move very, very far away, then what do you do with the tetrahedra?
I mean, you guys are real scientists, always looking for problems.
It doesn't work.
First, get excited. No, I mean, let me show you some more graphs where, you know, you can be more quantitative thing. I mean, we'll stay hand-wavy. Here's just a few more other ways you may have done sort of constant kernel smoothing or use a Voronoi density, sort of zooms in always on these regions. And in our case, you just notice full metric, and all the caustics are just perfectly smooth and really sort of stick out in this. And to me, in all these regions here, I really think that this is the exact density. It's actually the density that exists in all these sort of regions, or the filaments that we've looked at, where we didn't have a problem of some resolution elements which is going out of bounds, or all those regions, we still have enough resolution.
It's the exact density given that you have reproduced the universe by a finite number of sheets.
For sure.
Reality.
Oh, no. No, it's a single sheet. There is no.
But this was not a simulation of a single sheet. It is not a single sheet. For a single sheet, you're absolutely correct. If you have a 3D distribution, you basically have.
No, but
you don't resolve the sheets in between, you know, if you start over a Cartesian grid in X, Y, Z, and you don't have
fine cold dark matter, or even warm dark matter, those velocity differences will be so tiny, they will be impossible to see on the scale. You really didn't need, it is
extraordinary. If I look at one sheet, it goes a certain way. If I would take a sheet and put it a delta epsilon little offset, mm-hmm. That will have its shell crossing slightly earlier, later times, which means
not
add that on.
Not in these mildly nonlinear things. So all the things I'm pointing at, the caustics here on the outside, or the filaments that you have, they are mildly nonlinear in the sense that, you know, maybe quite nonlinear in a way, you know, that they're already virialized in two directions, but they have a very nice ordering in the tetrahedra, where the resolution elements are really as big as the features you're trying to resolve. But in the situation where you're thinking of a really chaotic orbits where tiny differences, whether in space or in velocity, already led to very large separations later on, that's what you're going to have in the centers of halos.
But also, to be clear, your warm dark matter is still an absolutely cold sheet with a warm dark matter power spectrum.
That's right. That's what we. That's the terminology I use for the. It's become kind of standard, but yeah, it's still the terminology I use. I only took one.
Are these the same as before, as the previous slide?
It's some zoom in on some outskirt of the halo.
The lumps are gone. But the SPH, for example, and so on. Oh, when I see your
because you're not on the filaments now.
But you're zooming on some part of the principle.
Yeah, and this is essentially a hot dark matter calculation. So there's essentially no substructure, even in the biggest 10 to 14 solar mass object. And I've chosen this just because these problems are very well defined. Numerically, because for a given resolution, I now can up the resolution, and I shouldn't have any new structures appearing. So that's why we're still playing with things that are totally not described in the real universe. But you know, they're much more sensible to study because I actually can hope to converge on a solution there. here's just comparing the particle distribution, but these are. Generally, a simulation with just 256 particles, you know, normally didn't look quite this good. Just one more. But I think I'll save us and sort of get to the point. What's nice now is since I can measure all these things directly at any single point, I can now do infinitesimally thin slices through the center of my biggest halo. In the CDM simulation, 40 megaparsecs on the side, there's a 10 to the 14 solar mass object, and it's totally illustrative, to be meant to be illustrative only. But what you notice is we really just make a density plot in a single slice, infinitely thin, and can plot things like the number of streams, which you see goes up to a good 100,000 already in the center. You sort of see how the material comes in on the sides, and then you may only have tens on the very outskirts here. And it gives you also a sense of
streams is the number of shell crossings. You call that streams.
Streams is if I am at a given point in space and I look up how many distinct parts of the same sheet can I find. Right? It's all one sheet. In phase space, it never tears, it never crosses, it always. And so.
Shell crossings.
Shell crossing is different. So shell crossing is when you have, you'd use it in the Sokovich case, exactly where you have one fold. And then when you did one folding, you went from one to three streamers. You did another folding, you would get five. Right. And so it's always the odd numbers that describe that. Okay, great. And you see sort of these filaments here have much fewer streams, of course. They're not as dynamically evolved. So you have much fewer streams there. Okay, but now more to the cool part, I think, that Peng was already on, in a way, is that what I can do now is go to the very center, pick a single point, and ask, what's the velocity distribution function in x, y, and z? Total velocity distribution function and the different x, y, and z
velocity component.
And, you know, looks a bit like a Maxwellian, but it has some extra tails out here. A perfect Maxwellian would just be a parabola in this diagram. But we measured it at a single point, right? And so the way this is done is you see that, okay, I'm in this point, I have 100,000 streams. So at this point, I find all the 100,000 tetrahedra that contribute to this point. For each of them, I have the velocity. So I'm in the tetrahedron, so I've got my four vertices. So I know the velocities at the four vertices. So we use sort of an inverse distance weighting, sort of Shepard's method, to get the velocity, to interpolate the velocities to any point in between. in the tetrahedron. And that's, so for every tetrahedron, I have the density of how much material is moving and at which velocity it's moving. Like, can plot exactly volume or mass weighted, this sense of mass weighted, to do the velocity distribution. You can do it in x, y, and z. So you have the full fine-grained phase space function.
So and you always have it. Only has right? one velocity.
See?
Each tetrahedron only has one velocity.
Yes, that's correct. So think back to the one big case.
The velocity function within the tetrahedron or something.
We do interpolation, where you know when I have these four vertices, and I now query for the velocity anywhere inside the tetrahedron, I do an inverse distance weighting to the velocities. Might as well, right? So of course this physics is fantastic now in the center, even though it was a very small simulation. If I move out 0.4 megaparsecs, it's not quite as good anymore. Just I have fewer samples, but that's actually correct. I mean, I just, you know, in this simulation, I only had this many streams. And so if I get even further out, you notice that I get quite different widths already by different components, so that's still just around the middle radius. I unfortunately don't remember exactly which point it was here or over here, but the whole question becomes interesting anyhow. If I only have 100 streams or 1,000, you know, what do I call a velocity dispersion anyhow? And we'll come back to that in a second because here, you know, we just compute the dispersion, just the square of the velocity, density weighted, averaged over all the streams. And that's the velocity dispersion that we get. And you see that things are somewhat colder in the center, because of a hot region out here. And in the dispersion sense, things are actually somewhat colder again, you know, out towards the variable radius. So it falls off again. Right, but that's really the microphysical velocity dispersion at a given point, and it doesn't sort of count the more bulk velocities that you might have. Just remember that we'll get back to that and sort of look at profiles in a second. Okay, what other things is it useful for? We already said that every time you fold, you go from 1 to, you always add 2 in the number of streams you have at a given point. What's really nice then, I can just ask, okay, which one have all the particles, this is a tiny one just to be able to plot points, which particles only count one stream? Their location, and just plot them up, and you say, yeah, it's essentially the entire volume in this thin slice. Then it counts the ones with the first caustic, okay? And how about the ones that have more than 3A, and you see right away you pick out the filaments, quite easily. So in a way, this of course is a very nice way to classify your simulations, if you want. And you know whether one should or not, we can sort of get back to in just a little bit, because here are some sort of statistics of these functions. So I can ask for as a function of the number of streams. Okay, everyone has at least one. Some have more. I can ask them, okay, what's the mass fraction in the bins that have these number of streams? And here, down here, we just call it cumulative. Okay, mass fraction in the entire universe that has streams more or counts more than these streams. What you notice is that you go to higher and higher resolution, the number of streams just always keeps going up. Right. And these were CDN calculations, and this makes total sense. Every time you increase the resolution, you have smaller objects. These smaller objects made filaments, sheets, halos, and they keep evolving. And so what you find is, the way you want to think about it, is as I increase the resolution, just the number of things that have one stream from 1,000 will just keep going up. Or you can think of it, of course, in the other direction, where you say, okay, the mass fraction of 20% will just always keep increasing with the resolution. So in CDM, you don't expect that to converge, or you know, you don't have an expectation of a correct answer because it really intrinsically is a lot more complicated than we can possibly simulate. You know, we have Earth mass objects that are already wound up, essentially all mass, early on. Now, this is true for volume fractions, then the same. You can sort of ask, okay, how much of the volume is in voids, so things that only come one stream. It's not even, you know, in the simulation, at one resolution, it's well defined. But when you do the resolution, it's like, why did I think, oh, if I have more resolution, I have even smaller void, and they just get less and less. So it's the volume fractions also don't converge in that sense. It's again, just what you expect. So. Okay.
So if I go back to the example of the single 1D example,
yeah.
And I sample this sinusoidal wave with a finite number of particles. If I get to a number of reps that gets larger than the number of particles, at some point, do I lose the ability to count new streams? Because
that's exactly right.
Exactly. So there is always that limit as well, right?
Totally. So now you think once you've got two particles that are in some orbit,
right.
Okay. So they started out and they're on this orbit. Right? Now, if they have a phase lag, at some point, they're going to go around like this. And now you're done. Right? I mean, it's actually done earlier than that. But now you're totally done. Because now there would be continuously more phase shift that you can't add anymore or represent. And you lose that. And so that's one part that you already have when we do, when you look at the number of streams in the calculation in the center of your halo, it still goes up like just a factor of 8, just like you expect. You have sort of more resolution, you can represent more streams, but then at some point that's it. And they can orbit as long as they want. And at least at these resolutions, which is very low, there's absolutely zero convergence at all in the number of streams, which is sort of interesting. Then another quantity I wanted to plot is Q, that people really like, is the coarse-grained phase-space distribution function, so the density over sigma Q, where sigma is the coarse-grained velocity distribution function. Now, I didn't measure the coarse-grained velocity distribution function, and the coarse-grained, the way people always calculate it on spherical shells, just all the distribution of the kinetic energy of particles in spherical shells just has the characteristic power law that everybody's been writing about. The sigma, however, that I use here is that sigma that you measure locally at every point, and then I average all those sigmas in a radial grid. And that sigma is different. And that's why you sort of get a flattening. It looks like there could potentially be already a convergence there.
Q is not phase-space density because it's computed in the configuration space, not in phase space.
Yeah, but I call it the coarse grain.
No.
The proximity is not even.
It's a Q, right?
Yeah.
So Q is in computed in radial shells. So it's computed in volumes of configuration space. So it has nothing to do with phase.
I totally agree. Actually, I don't want to defend it.
But it's the pseudo phase.
There's no metric.
It's not
so you can measure phase space density, no problem.
But sure, that's not what problem is.
There's no metric. You can measure density.
In fact,
metric density for non-metric spaces.
This is terminology. It's this funny quantity that people get when they do spherical shells and compute velocity dispersions in spherical shells. They like to, you know, many people like to plot that and are finding that you get a nice power law. That's there. And all I'm just
so what's really strange about that is you get the power law of Bechinger, some similar solution for reasons that.
We'll have lots of fun with that stuff, yeah? And many papers have been already written on it. But so this is the equivalent thing, actually, right, is the temperature or the density to the two-thirds. It's what we spend a lot of time plotting for galaxy clusters and arguing about, is there an entropy floor in galaxy clusters or not? When we do that with the Q, right, which this is just a the same quantity as this one, it's just to the power of minus 2/3. So the regular way people measure this, it always just drops like a power law like this. For us, this is different signal that actually returns over, more reminiscent of what we're used to from grid simulations of galaxy clusters.
By the way, are these warm dark matter simulations or cold dark?
This is cold dark matter.
So you're going to put this right in this? You know what it is? I think Navy would have expected that your method has better resolution. So, whereas the other one has a smoothing always, and therefore should underestimate it.
So what we have to worry about here is that we've got 100,000 tetrahedra that are all quite big. By the time you made this object, and you average over all of them. So as you get further and further in, it's always the same tetrahedra that you might be averaging over.
You're in that dimension that you cannot resolve.
Right, could be.
That phase makes beyond recognition.
I mentioned to you that we did this experiment with phase dense, the coarse grain phase dense. I think the results are very similar. It's also this rolling over.
So what is the Bechinger solution like in here?
It's just a power law. This power law is exactly this power law.
So you need differences that you can
Right. Think of the SDH profile versus the AMR profile.
No, I'm talking about what it below. So it continues at large scales. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it always ends at the very latest. Out here, you don't. It doesn't continue. Well, for some halos, you might just be right, lucky enough there. Anyhow, you sort of see that a little bit in the density profiles too. They generally, in our way of doing it, okay, that was that. They smoother towards the center, a bit more core. They make up for it on the outside. The mass, the linear array is of course is all the same. But the density structure in the center is somewhat different. But ours is even slightly higher center density. So you always want to compare. The solid line, the dash line, Voronoi. Yeah, we use the Voronoi for doing the densities, but it gives you the same answer as if you do particles, just your usual way. And so what you notice is that we get somewhat higher densities in the center. Can we trust this? Well, not clear, because we definitely lose resolution there, and we have lots of really large tetrahedra. And even if it were true, it wouldn't be self-consistent anyhow, because we use totally different forces in the calculation than this. So, you know, if this were the correct answer, it would have to be by coincidence. That's a positive way of saying it's probably wrong.
Starting from simulations that have a certain softening, right? So you're just optimizing the way you extract information. You're not creating more.
Absolutely. And, right. And that's what I love about this at the moment, is because it's so detailed, doing the density and the loss distribution, it helps you really sort of check on things on a simulation, which used to be hard, because you just had a bunch of particles there. And you didn't know, if you have a very noisy estimator or something, then how are you going to check? Did this particle do the right thing?
But I mean, the simulation itself does experience phase mixing, right?
Yes.
So, and you're assuming that there is no phase mixing, essentially, by conservation of fine grained phase density. So that's
you phase mixing. You phase mixing.
You do assume that within tetrahedron there is no phase mixing, right? So that conserves mass, right?
Right.
But real elements
right.
do not have those tetrahedra, right? They could be whatever.
Right.
So there is an assumption at that level, which probably is not correct in detail.
Like it keeps saying, at some point you run out of the resolution where your tessellation is just not good enough. So where the phase space has a lot more curvature, or the Sheehan phase has a lot more curvature than you can represent with straight lines.
I mean, you're not starting with completely cold initial conditions, right, when you initialize the simulation. I mean, you give your particle some velocities, right?
No, those are different. Those are fine velocities. Those are not. Those because it's a similar sheet, you have all those velocities absolutely perfectly in that discretization alone. So you don't lose anything there. It would only be different if you had a dispersion that you can't model with a single sheet in phase space. So you don't have that. The bulk velocity, of course, since the particles with those velocities define our resolution elements, they track exactly that part of the velocity.
The questionable part is more what I'm trying to check. Say that at your level of tetrahedra, you assume that particles move perfectly.
Yeah.
And the forces.
Which means forces are perfect, and that's not
You're not solving Blasius equation, you're solving something different.
So our method doesn't help the simulation be more accurate at all. I totally agree. This, for everything I told you right now, is post-processing. But what I also get a sense of is that the density estimate is a lot better than any density estimate we ever had. And that the image is alone.
It's not clear, right?
That's the thing. That we could have a fun discussion about whether we expect the simulation to actually do the right thing there to begin with. They always seem to do the same thing, so that we can totally agree with, and we show you many times. But whether it's the right thing, the density structure, the central density structure of halos, is independent of resolution. And you've experienced this over decades, I think. But you know what what these ways of thinking about, if you have particles that are being, when our method breaks down, it means the particles have been sheared apart so brutally far that they should have been spread over a much larger volume. That's when our method breaks down. We can't represent that with our tetrahedron. But when we just blindly apply it, one aspect of it is, I think, still quite correct, is that a lot of the mass is distributed between the particles. And that's something the simulation can never trace, because the particles themselves always carry the mass, and they just blindly orbit around like this, and you can never, or in all the approaches so far, we've never seen things sheared off. And learning from this method, how it evolves, the centers of just simple cold dark matter, only simulated halos are, makes you wonder whether the simulation has any chance of getting that right. But it's, I can't prove it yet. But just thinking this through with this method gives you a sense of, wow, this is actually a very complicated thing. I would have to have billions of streams, trillions of streams, and I would have to sample all these orbits with a huge number of particles to sample potential.
If different simulations which have different methods, use different methods, they would all be wrong, but it would be strange if they are wrong in the same way.
Well, I am surprised that the AMR methods that use adaptive softening still give the same answer.
So why would they make the same mistake and give the same answer?
Well, I think the big thing is actually the assumption that the particles are both tracers and the sources of mass. That's sort of what you get from the picture, just of looking at how our density estimator can be smooth, where any other one you would have picked, but it's a pick style of particle itself, cloud itself.
So you can remove two sets of particles, one is source and one is moved center.
That's what I would like to talk about next, which is what we've been doing the last few months.
The final stage is if you say you have such a thing as a collapsed halo, as a very light halo.
Right.
So if you say I represent that, this is the density distribution, so forget about the initial conditions here. I set up a relaxed halo where I specify the velocity dispersion, I specify the density profile. If my code retains that density profile, then arguably it gives the right answer. But I don't then seem to care whether I actually represent my space against it. I know that is the right answer.
That's right. Let me just do another version. Let's say n-body systems, simulated n-body systems, relax like star clusters. And once you get to very high particle numbers, you don't see any effects of this relaxation, because the relaxation time becomes very long. Now imagine that in your simulation, if you had an object that started out being 10 particles, in which certainly relaxation will have happened.
That's a different aspect.
The error that you make there would actually continue to influence the buildup of your object that later has a billion particles, then in principle, you could imagine how that error could have propagated all the way. And it'd be very difficult to prove that that's not what happened. But I don't want to get into that because it's all, none of us can prove it, but we all sort of think hard about arguments for and against
the
simulation's work.
I've never shown that's the case. Well, you said that people have checked that in velocity space and maybe in the first moment, the second moment of velocities, but never to the nth order of velocities, right? And it could be that the 16th order of velocities are changing over time and you don't see it because you haven't checked it.
And
you can never check it to infinite accuracy unless you actually analyze and check whether the actual fine grain distribution function doesn't evolve in time, but we don't know how that works.
And I think actually in an n-body system, right, because it can't get the same density profile with many different velocity distribution functions, but I think for a limited number of n, I would imagine that there's particular configurations of this velocity function density pair that may be favored. Because you have to achieve both. You have to sample the velocity distribution function and, of course, you have to get the right place to give the mass. And this may change with n. But it's just a worry, and I'm not saying, you know, I know either way. But what you can learn from this, though, is that the objects that we're studying are a lot more complex than the normies that we've talked about. And that's just because the number of streams and the number of folds that you had is much, much greater than the number of particles in the calculation. Okay, now let's pick two different sets of particles, one that gives mass, others that are trace fluid, and we use those then to source the potential, evict the tracers, and these tracers again inform us where to put the mass again. Okay, so I'm just using the density estimate that I showed you to solve the Poisson equation on top of it. Actually, let me not go through this. Let me just sort of say that your standard way, if you do a Sadovich pancake and you use a lot of force resolution, and this is just a particle mesh code, which is tree would look actually quite a bit worse in the sense that if you get a lot of two particle interactions in the center, it can lead to scattering and sort of break the nice properties of your phase space sheet that should have never cleared or crossed. You can lose that just by two body effects. In this new approach, the direct density estimator that doesn't happen. And it's robust to using different force resolution if you compare directly with the particle mesh. It's a tiny little thing in the center, so you say, like, why do I care? Let's sort of take the same wave, but now put a modulation in the other direction so that we get a little bit more action. So we have a plane wave collapsing in this way, and then we get a perturbation along this direction. And we're just following a paper by Delinier et al. In 1997. I studied this and compare our new method with the standard particle mesh. And we show the particle distributions and our density estimator for this. What you notice is that there's quite a bit of extra noise as it happens. And there's a number of structures which unfortunately don't come out well on this projector, but they just don't converge. So the question on exactly what do these wave structures look like as they increase the resolution, they keep changing in the standard way. We actually, I think, have very nice convergence. When you have yet higher resolution, you can represent this second sheet much finer yet. And here is a state where it's more evolved in time. Now our method does very nicely, converges very nicely.
What's the difference? So here you have the trace of particles as well?
Yeah.
The
one was standard particle mesh.
It's the PM code.
Just the PM code
on the left hand side.
But PM using many different sort of force resolutions.
Yeah.
So here we just vary the force resolution. And even that would violate what Nemoc has been on since the 1980s. I think he's actually quite right. There's many examples. You can show that if you use force resolution larger or much better than the mean particle separation, that you will get a lot of spurious effects that violate what the fluid would actually do. You see discreteness effects.
Yeah, but what's on the left then?
That's our new method. That's our new method.
But what do you do exactly? So you estimate density using your, and then you estimate it on the grid?
Right. So,
that's like a paper key?
Right. So, I mean, this is just particle mesh. So this one is also just a particle mesh version. It's just now with two particles, one that give mass, and they place at the centroids of the tetrahedra. So, okay, it's not the full implementation yet. So I'm not using exactly this density field yet in the calculation. All we do is, I say I have my tetrahedra, just like before. These are 6 times more than my regular particles. And now I say, instead of having the mass at the vertices, I have the mass in the centroid, in the positions of the centroids of the tetrahedra. And so it's those, in fact, I actually use 8 times more particles. I use a different tessellation. And so I have 8 more particles that now give a much smoother potential. And so if we just use that, do a regular cloud and cell density assignment on a grid, from that compute the potential, then differentiate the potential, get the forces to evict the other particles.
You still compute the density on a grid.
Yep.
So effectively, you're still doing some kind of smoothing. But you
but I'm also
smoothing because you're exactly at the grid value, but you still have a discreteness in the density. Doesn't that basically do the same as
the right, that's why I'm comparing sort of essentially the same gravity solver with this method where all you did is you separated tracers from the mass-giving particle.
But so here, you have analytical solutions for the growth of waves of different wavelength, and so, you know, you can show the pictures, but don't I just really want to know if the waves grow correctly?
Okay, so here is the error, RMS error, where you do just the Sadovich pancake before shell crossing, where you still have the analytic solution. And that one, the blue ones are the particle mesh, and our new method here at PCM is the sort of red line at 2 different times. And what the red one shows is of a nice, you know, as you increase the particle mesh resolution, so the force resolution, you continue to get smaller errors. We are getting, of course, flatten out, and that's just because of the experiment where you keep the number of particles.
Yeah, but that's constant. So that, I mean, in some sense, I can say that if I have small scale aliasing, it can affect my results at any wavelength, as opposed, so if I, you know, do something to suppress the aliasing and I look at the largest conceivable wavelength, I'll do better. But don't you really want to know that you're doing better at all the wavelengths you thought you were resolving when you did the simulation, rather than just at the very largest one?
Well, it was a single wave, and I just compared the old way to the new way, and the new way had a lower error. Now, perhaps look at this one, because that's sort of the classic problem that you've known for over 30 years, where if you run resolutions with high force resolution but low particle resolution, so here we always use the same force resolution, a 5+ cube particle mesh, to do the forces, but in this case we use 128 particles, 256 particles, 5+ cube particles. And what you see is the typical breakup of all these filaments into halos. So this is cloud and cell maximum intensity projection, brings it out. Has been studied many times, and I think I also figured before from Wong and White, but did it a few years ago again. What they found also was that it's a very hard problem to combat, to get rid of these artificially fragmented things in filaments, because you really have to, you know, radically keep increasing your mass resolution to get rid of some of those halos. So at this point, you already have as many particles just such that the mean particle separation is, in fact, one grid zone in the particle mesh solver, and then looks actually quite good. It's still, anyhow, here's exactly the same experiment with our technique, using the tetrahedra centroids as the positions where the mass goes. So again, not full density yet, but the first approximation. And what you notice is that all the artificial halos are just completely absent. And this is also what you would have expected just from the visualizations I showed you earlier. And so I think we can do actually now warm and hot dynamic simulations quite well, study whether filaments and sheets under which conditions you could have form out.
Sure. So I may have mentioned when I stepped out. Do you have force resolution with the method or not? four softening?
Yep, because this one.
Use four softening.
This one I'm showing is just a particle mesh again, so I still put a density on a mesh. Then on the mesh, I compute the potential, then I differentiate the potential, and so that gives me a natural softening of two times the grid cell that. And but it's identical for both of these calculations. I mean, or the ones you always
think that's different is in the density estimate that it goes into the Fourier transform for my potential.
Exactly. And the fact then that right, that the particles that used to give the mass now have zero mass, it's just a hopefully faithful tracer of the fluid flow.
You're doing it, it's with a lot more resolution, so it's not completely fair, the comparison you're doing, right? Because you have a lot more, if you count how much computing time you use, you use a hell of a lot more in the GPM, because you have effectively more resolution. You have lots more particles, in effect, in practice. Than, so when you say 512 qubits, that is just a grid.
I thought cubed is the same portrait.
You effectively have a lot more resolution in the image. I'm not saying it does better, but
this one,
any effect.
This one, this one may take about 3 times longer than this one. Sorry, the other way around. This one, no, it's correct. This one takes about 3 times longer than that one. Because Carlos's point one was that this these use 8 times, and I actually didn't still did it wrong. Comparing these two, this one has 8 times more mass giving particles.
Yes,
still the same all the force things, but I only have to interpret the forces to the tracer particles.
So right? 1.8 cube is tracer ones. What is
1.8? 1.8 cubes is for tracers. So I would have 256 cubed mass giving one, but only to do the density. Then I get the potential, and then I only have to get the force back onto the 128 cubed particle.
Yeah, there's a space resolution, mass resolution.
I know.
Usually they're the same, so, but in this case they're not longer because you're using different particles, the force calculator, the density calculator. Right. So I'm not saying it's not better, you're saying it's kind of slightly unfair to compare.
All I'm saying is a factor of 3, otherwise you would have thought it's a factor of 16.
To be true, yes. In Rito, this small-scale fragmentation, you would probably sacrifice factor 20.
I'm not that. Sure. What I'm saying is that the comparison is like unfair, but...
So the approximation that you use for... that you use to try to sell interpolations of mass-giving particles instead of mapping the heater.
Exactly. And so that's what makes it so fast, and you know.
The particle itself is the size of the particle mesh. It has nothing to do with the size of the data either.
Exactly. But the centroids now are at much better locations, and the traces have a chance.
So would you say that you have the most gain already? This may be not forming the tetrahedron. What are you saying?
Not
before I do it.
It depends on your. You know, what level of accuracy do you need for the particular thing?
So you're using the data here are harder to do?
Yeah. Although there is an analytic potential for homogeneous tetrahedra that you could use.
But I thought we're just assigning density, right? You just want to assign the density of your tetrahedra.
Yeah, let's discuss more. There's a whole range of actually of how you can continue.
What's the thing that we saw earlier, though, that conceivably could be a concern, which is just if. So it's good now that you're getting rid of objects that are spurious, and so the mass function that was spurious is now smooth. But if the mass function I thought I resolved well changes, then that's an issue. And from earlier pictures you showed, it looks like that was going to happen.
Now, actually, the mass functions on the high mass end don't change at all. So all this stuff really, because there you have so many particles, it actually doesn't matter.
Your visualization made it look like they did.
The density structure of them has changed slightly.
Can you explain the statement that was there on the right?
I had a statement?
Yeah.
Right. No. Oh, so yeah, we're still having problems. I mean, we're not the biggest expert with the halo finders, but now when your filaments are so nicely together, you have friends of friends style things, really pick up lots of this stuff.
You're friends of friends, that's the thing.
Yes.
Right. It's still weird stuff that gets picked up.
Hope doesn't matter. Friends of friends with standard parameters will just make the entire filament.
that will answer much. Exactly. And so we can use our method, and we started doing that, where we just sort of pick the number of streams as sort of the minimum requirements. And so this way you can avoid anything that just has a small POSIX. There's a bunch of things, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, it's just you don't just use it right out of the box.
So,
and then
so, you can have fun. So which one you try? I mean, I don't understand why you think,
Let me delete this.
We tried so far. Which one did we try?
Still gonna be an all-time video.
Fine, and we did some stuff with Rockstar, and you know, there's a lot of things that.
So friends are just friends of friends on these scales, so it doesn't matter.
Teach me, please. No, that's what I was saying. Sometimes Rockstar, then I built we built our own, actually using the number of streams in the objects to pick out centers, and then just use variable overdensity. We tried a number of different things, and so far.
Everything you used is kind of.
No. No, the number of streams is not a.
The number of streams is okay. Yeah. I don't know what the problem is. Or looks at some point in the equator
or whatever. Just teach me, I'm like, you know, I'm new in this dark matter.
Are you doing this calculation? Are you calculating the
flex particles based on
the
shell, the streams on the fly? Every time you have a new shell crossing being counted?
Wonderful thing is for the simulations, you don't have to worry about it at all.
You don't have to worry about it, but if you could have high enough time resolution, you could even count the number of shell crossings beyond, like you have the spatial resolution to count. Right? The issue that you could basically go, that face wraps beyond recognition, but if you have high enough time resolution and you count them on the fly, you could in principle.
We in fact already implemented a code that does refinement on the fly in face wraps. So, but you know, I'm not showing results yet. It's just so much beautiful physics, and it's, you know, it's just a textbook that I should have read more accurately back then. Anyhow, so is it totally awesome or what? Well, yeah, kind of. Some things are still really worrisome. So we do a density power spectrum, for example, standard PM, just always gives the same answer. I'm actually kind of a little bit puzzled still of how that happens over such a wide range of particle numbers at the same force resolution, that in this very nonlinear regime, you always get exactly the same. In our approach, we always find somewhat higher, larger power. In this very nonlinear detail, I mean, this was a very small box, of course, that we simulated. We always have somewhat higher power, and part of that is because the density structures of halos that we have is different.
You were showing halos on that scale. How are you doing this? Are you computing the Fourier transform of the two-point correlation function of your particles, or are you first putting a grid and computing the density on the grid and computing the
particles? It's a CIC 1024 cubed grid.
So when you do that, at each grid point, do you compute the density at that grid point, which you can do? Or do you compute the average density in a region around that grid point?
We haven't done that yet because we wanted to compare exactly the same way. And so we did the CIC density assignment, in our case, the mass-giving particles in standard PM, the usual way, against CIC. But, you know, it's a result that then you could teach me. And the other one was the one sort of advecting things along in phase space. You know, as Andre pointed out right at the beginning, of course, individual particles always do perfectly fine advecting. So even if you're, go along, for us with tetrahedra, you know, you could imagine that if we had a tetrahedra, like we have much fewer particles, but we now have them connect here. As time goes on, they're over here. And they could really cross like that and just completely lose resolution. So at some point, we really just don't trust in particular very high-dense region, very evolved ones. And so we understand that there's a good reason why we would get a different answer at high density in these calculations. But there's really no other way than trying to refine on this, which if you refine on this, you already know that you're not going to simulate CDM. Does this happen at redshift 100 for everything? So everything already is totally wound up by the time you ever see it later. So you can just hope as you really think you'll ever get to find in phase space structure and get a converged answer on it in CDM. But maybe we can paste it together if we do the right experiments of, you know, numerical experiments like that. Okay, sorry for keeping you guys everywhere so long. But okay, so it's a sheet. There's a three-dimensional manifold in 60 phase space. And, you know, it's great to think about it that way. You don't have to run a new simulation or anything. You know, you can get a not only a pretty picture, but you can measure quite deep things about the velocity of the distribution function, how many streams you have, and the like. It's fun for the large scale structure, but right away you learn that large scale structure, any quantities that you know, you can define Boyd filament sheets. It's not a, it's an ill-defined thing in CDM. Many people, I think, have that pointed out already, but here you just make that very explicit. You always have to think about this and make it with a scale. You know, smooth your density builder, do something that connects it to a scale. Visualization. Here, I mean, at least we have the impression it really helps us a lot in analyzing and finding errors of the typical n-body techniques, because as soon as particles don't go on trajectories that fit with the fine-grained phase-space structure, it picks it out quite easy. And some of the new simulation codes we're developing have a few things that make it exciting, that, you know, gets us excited of trying to continue and to work on it, but we've already appreciated now that many of those things would have very strong limitations that will not allow it to become the same workhorse as the type of calculations we have already. But hopefully they can help us to really use a completely different way, not just different codes that, you know, calculate the forces differently, because it's essentially the only difference that we have between our start metal only codes is the way they calculate the forces. Everything else is identical. And if I understand it right, yeah, there's time saving. Sorry. Okay. But otherwise, fundamentally, it's exactly the same thing. And so, you know, it'd be great to have one way to do an independent check of whether the results that you love and cherish and try to use to disprove the model are in fact actually correct. Thanks.
My focus barrier, he's the easiest, right? He did something not dissimilar to this in the sense that he, I mean, for each particle and solve the Boltzmann equation as you go along.
Yes, so
imagining the each particle kind of trick inside and for then fully solve the Boltzmann equation.
Well, actually, I think what he does, if I sort of understand this right, at every location, you have to expand around and you look at the sheet. And it's funny because the math comes out very, very similar. Yeah. Like, so you have a matrix, and you're sort of trying to evaluate the specific volume, how the volume changed. But for every particle location, he can sort of find out what is the local sheet density.
Right.
Just like us, where we say, okay, well, actually, between those particles, I can just measure what's the sheet density. It depends how far apart they are. And finally, if you look at our volume formula, like the tetrahedron, it's just this determinant of to the next particle, very similarly, because it is that same math,
right,
expanding linearly around your phase space sheet and estimate how much it's changed. So that part is similar. What that method can't do is tell you how many streams you have at a single location. For that, you then have to say, ah, wait a minute, let me take a big volume where I know the total density. And now all my particles tell me what their individual sheet density is. And so in order to make up that whole total density, given this average sheet density, you can estimate, oh, I probably need a trillion streams. But you wouldn't know that at any location. So if that were anisotropic, then you could have wrong answers like that. That's one. And the other thing is, because you don't know which streams to average over, you also cannot do our trick of measuring the velocity dispersion at a single point. And so this, in that sense, is much more powerful. However, by tracing it for individual particles, he doesn't suffer from this issue that our tetrahedra, this regularization,
right,
maybe just lost.
Yeah.
But it was instructed that in his papers, he used much larger force softenings, and I think put quite a bit of work in order to make the thing work.
Yeah.
it's very
interesting. Converging for a long time.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
And kind of where the trip was very converging.
Yeah, almost 14 larger something, I think, was part of it. I don't know what else.
It's a similar question with your last point here, less to body effect. But if you use your new density finder and you discretize that on a grid, as you do in order to go to calculating the forces, don't you have much larger density fluctuations from one grid point to the other than in the previous case, and therefore don't you expect larger
Actually, when we
because
do slice,
it depends on whether I have one more crossing or not, I can just have a jump in density from one grid point to the other.
I don't quite have it here, but the potentials are much smoother. So here on top is sort of the typical CIC potential that you would get. So imagine differentiating this to get the force on all the particles. And here is our potential. So it's much I'm not concerned. Okay. So it's much smoother.
Part of it explain is, what is wrong with my reasoning? Because
in our case, when we have two particles coming, and by chance they just crossing, they sit on the same point. In the old way, both of them just add the full mass to it. In our case, now it actually, they may have a tetrahedra behind them, and so part of their mass gets divided up now in 8 different tetrahedra that sort of live, quite anisotropically.
But the density estimate that people use in these old embodied simulations always uses a kernel that's much larger than,
It's a single grid cell in a particle mesh structure. So you can really, the Cloudian cell interpolation you can think of is, it's like a top hat that has the size of a single grid cell. That
you just count the number of particles in the grid. That's what it does?
No, every particle you deposit as if it were a cube, the size of a single grid cell. And so if it sticks a little bit into the left cell, you give that fraction of it in that part. Right? If it's fully contained, if it sits exactly in the center of the cell, all its mass is deposited to that cell. But then it linearly interpolates.
It's called the area weight of the function. You can think of it as a fully transformed space. So the window function is much broader than that. So that's what
in the PN case. Sorry? Well, in this case. In the new case.
So the tetrahedra, because the tetrahedra they get mapped onto the mesh.
Yeah, I would disagree that that's a good way to think about it. Because it's highly anisotropic.
Yeah, right, but they have an anisotropic window function.
Right.
Which is much broader.
Which
is much
normally you would argue would not give you smoother potentials. But maybe it's just magic.
Depends what you think.
So why don't you just, instead of sampling the tetrahedra with particles, just use the tetrahedra as your cloud that you're putting on the cells?
Let's work on this next week. So the key thing to do is to actually deposit the tetrahedra and it's just a lot of operations that you do, particularly if you have some tetrahedra that are quite large, because you have to touch a lot of cells. Now, if you're parallel, you actually also have to export that, make sure the other one does that. They can spend a lot of time, and that's why, when we first did that in November, I was like, wait a minute, we could just really quick, and that's already decent. And so I think the force calculation right now is not the big thing I worry so much about. It's more the other part, and that's why.
You want to do the kind of
so it's going to be great, but I would like to do it later. Because the ideal thing that the calculation would suggest is that you do full AMRs in 3D from your space with the density. Right? So you really can control the gradient of the potential that you refine on that. And at the same time, you want to refine in phase space, that you actually make sure that you can represent the finding distribution. That would be the ultimate way of doing this correctly.
Yeah, you want to do your near body call, right? You just have to do AMR, right? You couldn't do the part. It's not suited to this. So if you want to have high resolution, you can do an array style or just an AMR. But you cannot do the
two-body
correction.
To do
high end. But if you want to do really high resolution simulation, you have to do AMR.
Nope. So
depth will always be limited by the size of
Yeah, no, but you can do it. You can also do a G code that does this. Here are some results from a G code.
Which we also can do a G code for this.
Yeah. So the.
But yeah, I can see how it is.
The top is our method, and the bottom is standard gadget. So what you notice is that we still have some artificial fragmentation. There's a few little guys that are still orbiting in there. But it was much, much less, and you can see it again here now in that filament than in your traditional way. And the only way in our case so far to get rid of it again is to use larger softening. But we can do larger softening. I know.
So the focus must it's one dark matter.
Hot dark matter, like 55 dB, but
okay, it's one dark matter gadget in the bottom and in the top.
There's our other name code.
The PM code with the...
No, it's also a tree-like code that sort of gives you high force resolution.
It's a tree code with this way it's estimated
the
density.
If you use particles, you can use a tree code.
Yeah.
Right,
exactly.
So the density assignment is still using particles, or the mass-giving elements are still particles, so you can use a tree code and calculate for
it. Right, exactly. You just think of it like it just has to calculate potentials. And so, right, you know,
then tree code, I mean, where does density enter there? You count masses, right, in particular.
Exactly. Instead of even doing a density assignment, you just you start right away at the masses. And it's not ideal. I mean, I would really prefer to do this in a...
Where does your method come in that case? Because there's no density estimate.